Well, thanks for coming out. I'm Zach Levinson. This is Edwin Ackerman. I'm coming from Greensboro, North Carolina. You're from
Syracuse.
And today we're going to be talking about the class composition of populism. I'll be talking a bit about right populisms. He'll be talking about left populism, in a specific case of left populism. Fortunately, we just heard from the third panelist this morning, Shefka Kumral, that she had an emergency and can't make it. We're going to try to Skype her in, but didn't work. So I'm going to start by talking a little bit about this resurgence of right populisms around the globe in the past couple of years. So over the last few years, we've seen the emergence of countless explanations for the rise of authoritarian populists around the globe. And today I want to talk about two poles around which these explanations tend to be grouped. So in the cases of what I'm going to call northern populisms, it's most common to blame the group that we all know called the white working class. I'll begin this talk by talking about the limits of this explanation in relation to the rise of Trump here in the US, but we could just as well make the same argument about UKIP and Brexit, or even the rise of the National Front in France, or the AfD in Germany. I'll then move on to cases of southern populisms, which tend to be framed, I'm going to argue, in a diametrically opposed way. If northern populisms are blamed on increasingly precarious white workers, southern populisms are frequently described as classic cases of revanchism. As Neil Smith famously defined the term, revanchism expresses what he calls a race, class, gender terror. This is a quote from his book, The New Urban Frontier. Expresses a race, class, gender terror felt by middle and ruling class whites who are suddenly stuck in place by a ravaged property market, the threat and reality of unemployment, and the decimation of social services, and the emergence of minority and immigrant groups, as well as women, as powerful urban actors. So while there's quite a bit going on in this definition, I want to dwell for a moment on its class character, which Smith defines as middle and ruling class revenge against the lower classes and socially marginalized. So we can think of Smith's revanchism as a precursor to the version of neoliberalism we get from someone like, let's say, David Harvey, a coordinated class project of bourgeois restoration from above. In his brilliant book, Incarcerating the Crisis, Jordan Camp reworks Smith's concept, allowing us to avoid thinking about revanchism as simply opposed from above. Instead, he insists that revanchism requires legitimation from the lower classes and marginalized elements of the population. That it must simultaneously appeal to what he calls, following Gramsci, their common sense. So in order to make these appeals successfully, this sort of politics requires what I'm going to argue today is a cross-class alliance, giving both dominant and dominated class fractions a stake in the game. I want to argue today that this approach to thinking about politics as alliance building is precisely what's missing from these bifurcated analyses of the current populist wave. So first, I'll demonstrate why the white working class formulation is so specious in the case of northern populisms. And then I'll show why the blame it on the rich formulation only gets us so far in explaining southern populisms. As in the case of Trump, it was a creation of a cross-class coalition that enabled Bolsonaro's resounding victory in Brazil. After explaining the importance of cross-class alliances, I'll return to Camp's critical reformulation of Smith and use it to talk about some of the broader literature on populism today. But first, Trump. So according to conventional wisdom, Trump owes his election to the white working class. The standard narrative is a Democratic Party steadily abandoning organized labor, progressively severing their historic connection with the class. Left without any obvious explanation for their own plight, Trump's able to capture them with an alternative narrative. Democrats don't represent workers, but transnational capital, the people Bannon, of course, called globalists, and they're busy offshoring American jobs from above and letting in cheap, undocumented labor from below. So note that this is a story that narrates the process of realignment in purely class terms, slipping in the modifier white only after the fact. With the elites uniting with the immigrant precariat, the workers Trump hails as the people are then, in this explanation, left in the cold, their only hope residing in the figure of the populist. This is why the wall is so important in his telling. Well, practically speaking, does nothing to reduce the inflow of labor or the outflow of jobs, it represents Trump's central promise, bounding the national popular, which is but another way of saying that it collapses the rebuilding of the nation and the hailing of the people into a single project of making America great again. It all works out rather neatly, and it makes Trump's protectionist turn intelligible. But it's an explanation premised entirely upon a theory of the working class in search of a savior, one that imagines the white working class as Trump's primary base. But exit polls from 2016 reveal that the majority of those making less than $100,000 annually voted for Clinton, whereas the majority of those making more than that sum voted for Trump. This didn't stop the media from framing Clinton's unexpected loss in terms of a downwardly mobile white working class who resented the cosmopolitan elitism of the Democratic voter base. But there's a dangerous slippage in these portrayals from the white working class to the working class more broadly, which, as we've seen, did not, by and large, vote for Trump. Indeed, as Sarah Jaffe has convincingly demonstrated, once we take into account some of the largest sectors of waged employment, including healthcare, service work, measly 11% of the working class is comprised of white men. And when white workers did opt for Trump, we need to be careful not to read this as some inevitable outcome of economic restructuring. Most workers of color, of course, did not support Trump. I'm not arguing here that a substantial block of white working class Obama voters didn't cast their ballot for Trump. They absolutely did. But as a recent paper in Public Opinion Quarterly demonstrates, there's no relationship between their class position and vote switching. Wealthier white voters were just as likely to switch their vote. Racism is, after all, a relative constant in American politics. Trump was not alone in this regard. So across the pond, Brexit was consistently framed in terms of the so-called UKIP effect. Nigel Farage was said to marshal a malleable white working class base for the Leave vote, convincing them to finally break with Labour. But just as in our own country, this isn't what actually happened. The lion's share of UKIP's votes came from defecting Tories and Liberal Democrats, not Labour. More to the point, as Richard Seymour points out, the pro-Brexit contingent was hardly a bastion of the white working class. In reality, its share of support among unskilled workers was much lower than among managers, executives, and owners of companies. Much as was the case in the US, this was a cross-class coalition conjured into existence through the deployment of various racialized protectionisms, and above all, a moral panic surrounding immigration. So now let's compare these northern populisms to some of their counterparts in the South. The election of Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil late last year wasn't blamed on the white working class, but as Vincent Bevins put it in the New York Review of Books at the time, on, quote, rich white Brazilians. The Washington Post ascribed his victory to, quote, white men and wealthy voters, and Bloomberg described Bolsonaristas as, quote, hailing from Rio de Janeiro's elite with children in the finest private schools. This is to say nothing of the business press, who nearly unanimously described him as a boon for markets, with, of course, the Wall Street Journal openly endorsing him. To be fair, plenty more serious analysts investigated his appeal to evangelicals, ex-soldiers, and exhaustion with existing parties. But in the prevailing international media narrative, Bolsonaro was the muscular champion of capital coming to retake the country from the PT, the Workers' Party, who over the course of a decade and a half, it was alleged, plunged the country into a double crisis. We can read these twin crises, economic and political, as two opportunities for revanchism in the prevailing narrative. So first, there's the economic crisis brought about by declining Chinese demand for Brazilian commodities. Bolsonaro was able to represent this as the fault of the PT, claiming to avenge finance capital as a revanchist. And second, there's the political crisis brought about by Lava Jato, Operation Car Wash. Just as with the economic crisis, Bolsonaro was able to pin the political crisis on the PT, allowing him to posture as a latter-day Pinochet, a living embodiment of bourgeois reaction. Never mind the fact that his predecessors from the PT, Lula and Dilma, were marginal or non-players in the Lava Jato scandal, respectively. But was Bolsonaro actually the representative of Brazil's ultra-wealthy? As Matthew Aaron Richmond has noted, the middle and upper classes only comprise a quarter of the electorate. When we look at exit polls from the first round of the election, we find something surprising. While members of the wealthiest income brackets overwhelmingly supported Bolsonaro, so too did those earning between 2 and 5 minimum wages. 39% planned to vote for Bolsonaro, compared to 18% for Haddad. And that's in this group making between 2 and 5 minimum wages, which is not the poorest group, but say lower to middle working class. Even among the poorest income bracket, Haddad barely edges out Bolsonaro, revealing quite a bit of support among the working and precariously employed classes. Something similar happens when we look at the results in terms of race. Whites overwhelmingly voted for Bolsonaro, but so too did those of a mixed race background. Even among black Brazilians, Haddad barely edged out Bolsonaro. Given these results, we can't reduce Bolsonaro's victory to a project of bourgeois revanchism, unless by revanchism we mean something closer to Jordan Camp's use of the word, which involves creating broad support among the popular classes. Thus, we do better to focus less on antipatismo, this kind of obsessive fixation on the PT, the Workers' Party, and more on Bolsonaro's tough-on-crime rhetoric and alliance with Pentecostal churches. As violent crime continues to spike in Brazil's small and medium cities, police are largely ineffective in keeping murder rates down. In their place, death squads and militias have waged surprisingly popular dirty wars in favelas around the country, and Bolsonaro has been among their most vocal defenders. This, and his support for liberalizing gun control, allows him to appeal to residents in Brazil's urban peripheries, bringing them into his cross-class alliance. This actually isn't too far off from Duterte's approach in the Philippines. His approval rating of over 78% most recently among the urban poor is surely rooted in a generalized frustration with the epidemic of drugs and violence that no politician has successfully curtailed. Duterte's open support for death squads isn't purely rhetorical. More than 5,000 alleged criminals have officially been executed since 2016, and according to the latest reports in the New York Times, it's actually probably upwards of 20,000 people killed by these death squads since he was elected in 2016. You might compare this with Bolsonaro's stated support for extrajudicial killings. Not to mention the military junta that reigned for 2 decades until 1985, which he frequently frames as a more efficient means of dealing with a crime spike. We might even fruitfully compare it with Trump's war on so-called regulations in general, which he imagines in the abstract as simply red tape inhibiting the successful achievement of stated policy goals. Civil rights in the face of police interrogation play a similar role in the discourse of Duterte and Bolsonaro. Civil rights interfere with fighting crime, and so these leaders appeal to state-sanctioned vigilantism, of course a contradiction in terms. Elsewhere, we can imagine other ways that valorizing extra-legality serves as a means of appealing to the urban poor. In Hungary, we could take Viktor Orban's zero-tolerance immigration policy as a case in point, Trump's Muslim ban effectively realized. Or in Turkey, Erdogan's consolidation of power in relation to the twin specters of Gulenism and Kurdish nationalism. In all these cases, populist leaders characterized as revanchist did not solely act on behalf of a fraction of capital, eager to restore its class power. Instead, they construct cross-class alliances, especially drawing on urban workers, as well as the un- or precariously employed. These cross-class alliances, then, undergird the rise of authoritarian populisms in both northern and southern national contexts. We need to be alert to this fact in light of the most common ways of explaining populist dissension, which remain unnuanced: white working class in the north, finance capital in the south. In both contexts, we observe that popular legitimacy needs to be actively constructed through a series of rhetorical operations that consolidate cross-class coalitions on the basis of material appeals. In both the North and the South, populists present their politics on multiple registers, aligning different interest groups into coherent blocks. We can think of multiple rhetorics that might matter to different class fractions for different reasons, say, corruption, security, religion, gender traditionalism and antipatismo in Brazil, or economic protectionism, tax cuts, crypto-racism, hypernationalism, troglodyte masculinism in the United States. So leaders need not develop singular rhetorics that appeal to everyone at once, but instead need to articulate these various rhetorics into a project that appears holistic rather than piecemeal. Thank
you. Picking up on kind of the organizing question of the panel, which was the question of whether we should understand populism as a specific configuration of particular class fractions, right? That is, whether different class configurations yield left or right-wing populisms. I want to focus my talk today on the case of López Obrador's victory in the past presidential elections in Mexico, which arguably is the sort of first left-wing populist to actually reach power, left-wing populist of this era, right? Of this era of resurgent populisms to actually reach power, right? I want to focus on that, and I want to focus specifically on this question of anti-corruption discourse, right? And how, as I'll argue, this produced a break in a historical voting block between middle and upper classes, right? And it was able to fold in, to subsume, in a sense, middle class sectors into a left coalition supporting redistributive policies. Right? Now, the basic starting point for me is what Poulantzas had to say about fascism. So let me just kind of lay that out a little bit. For Poulantzas, barring on Gramsci, fascism emerges in the absence of a hegemony, of a crisis of representation, where dominant classes can't make the claim to leadership stick. Right? He's talking, of course, of the crisis of the 20s and the 30s, an ongoing struggle there between capitalist and working classes that leads to a stalemate and fascism emerging there as a third force that is, you know, claiming to transcend this ongoing squabbles. Now, key to this rise for him is the capturing of the petty bourgeoisie, right? Which, I mean, I'm going to kind of distort as generally the middle classes, right? But it does have this more specific meaning for him. The petty bourgeoisie has this traditional element of small-scale production and commerce and this what he calls non-productive salaried employees, which sound a little anachronistic to us, like white-collar, basically service employees. But the point is, it's this ambiguous in-between sector, right? And the capturing of the sector becomes a sort of key moment in the surge of fascism. Now, this is a politically unstable group by its very nature, given its ambiguous class position. It can be swayed, he thinks, in either left or right-wing directions. In the case of interwar fascism, as the crisis economic and political intensifies, He says, and here I'm quoting, the historical role of fascism was to achieve an alliance between big capital and the petty bourgeoisie in the very conjuncture in which their contradictions were being acutely intensified. Right? So what is this referring to? The idea is the petty bourgeoisie does have a basic general anti-capitalist worldview, anti-big capital, right? That in order for, say, the fulfillment of what they would consider this sort of natural capitalism of permanent competition, you would need to actually combat big capital, transnational capital, monopoly capital, right? So there's an anti-capitalist element to their ideology by default. In the context of an economic crisis and a crisis of representation, there's an increasing split between that petty bourgeoisie and the upper classes. But fascism comes and actually sutures together precisely at the moment in which they were breaking apart, right? And that is the historical function of fascism for him, right? So I suggest this is a useful way. I mean, we can sort of discuss it, but it's a useful way of thinking about right-wing populisms. But what I want to suggest as well is the question of whether left-wing populism is the reverse of this phenomenon, right? If right-wing populism is the suturing of the petty bourgeoisie with the upper classes, is left-wing populism the suturing of this petty bourgeoisie with the working classes, right? The creation of that alliance. Right? So that's the basic sort of premise going forward here, right? Now, López Obrador's victory this past presidential elections in Mexico is hard to overstate. He wins with 53% of the vote. That's a whopping 30 points more than his closest contender. Right? Wins the most votes in the at the presidential level in Mexican history by the widest margin since the democratic transition in 2000. Wins in all but one of the 32 states in the country, a dozen of which give him over 60% of the vote, prevails in 80% of municipalities, over 90% of electoral districts. I mean, this is seriously a landslide, right? And his party as well captures a majority in the Senate, in the Congress, in the governorships that were up for grabs, in the state assemblies that were up for grabs. So essentially, you have a complete turnover, a shakeover of the political arena overnight. Right? And now, what's key, I think, to understanding also this, this moment is that now, 3 months plus into his presidency, his approval ratings are continuing to go up. Right? He begins with a very high approval rating in December when he takes office of in the upper 60s, and now past the first 100 days of office, it's close to the 80s, right? So some measures even put him in the mid 80s, right? So it's an overwhelming sort of moment of rare consensus around the country, right? And this, I should say almost parenthetically, in the context of a super hostile press. So you have a big kind of gap between really the sentiment of the general population and a pretty virulent press. Right? Now, López Obrador is in some ways kind of the sort of textbook populist. Like rhetorically, the main narrative that he presented during the campaign and even before that is of a battle between what he sometimes refers to as literally the good and wise people versus what he calls the mafia in power. Right? This notion of the mafia in power is the central category around which he is mobilizing, right? And refers, it's a nebulous category, but refers basically to the cronies of a rentier state. Right? And returning to the central question here of the paper, I think nothing exemplifies better the nature of this new electoral bloc that's emerging in the context of a crisis of representation as this issue of fighting corruption, right? Which is conventionally a petty bourgeois or middle class concern, right? So what I want to lay out here is how this issue, which is again conventionally thought of as a petty bourgeois issue, can be used in this context, is used as a way to legitimize the redistributive functions of the state. In other words, how these middle class concerns are folded into, subsumed into a project of the left, right? A project that advances redistribution. So let me step back a little bit and lay out kind of the history of this question of corruption here in the country. So former Mexican president Enrique Peña Nieto of the PRI, he left office in December 2018 with the lowest approval ratings since polls became widespread in the country. Right? During his 6 years in the presidency, Mexico's ranking in Transparency International's yearly corruption perception index dropped an alarming 30 places. Right? His approval rating tanked accordingly, starting at around 54% in 2012, ending at 24% by the end of his term in 2018. So not surprisingly, last year's presidential elections focused on this issue of fighting corruption. And this prompted a national conversation ongoing, of course, about the very definition and causes of corruption. So during the campaign, López Obrador made the case that corruption wasn't a series of isolated scandals, but a systemic byproduct of neoliberalism, right? Explicitly stated in those terms. The neoliberal period beginning in the 1980s had increasingly outsourced state functions to private companies. I'm laying out López Obrador's argument here, ushering under the table competition for privileged access to government contracts and the purchase of hitherto state-owned enterprises. The title of a chapter of López Obrador's 2018 book, The Way Out, made the argument succinctly. The chapter is titled Privatizing, Synonym of Stealing. The PRI ruled Mexico without interruption from 1929 to 2000. And what's important to understand here is that in that period, there was a sort of series of mechanisms to secure control that involved corruption as a central glue. The PRI built this quasi-corporate structure that secured the power of a wide array of union bosses, particularly in the state-owned enterprises. These union leaders were decidedly undemocratic, working in the service of the party and the state, and enjoying unchecked reign over union dues and other state resources. Of course, the PRI itself had emerged as a result of a compromise between conflicting elites in the aftermath of the revolution of the early 20th century. So the PRI was to serve as this vehicle that would grant access to the spoils of the state. Now, in the early 80s, as Mexico enters sovereign debt crisis, and as in many places you know the story well, the global south, there's a process of debt restructuring that involves essentially the undertaking of neoliberal measures. In Mexico, this rise of neoliberalism coincided with the very gradual transition to democracy of the turn of the century, that is, with the period of the PRI losing power, relatively speaking, right? So neoliberalism and democracy at the turn of the 21st century in Mexico were parallel to each other as discourses. Right? This is very important, I think, to understand, because this gives the kind of sort of theoretical backing to the particular bloc that existed prior, voting bloc that existed prior to this election. So because for most of the PRI's tenure, state enterprises and union leadership had become synonymous with corruption, the discourse of privatization and union busting in Mexico came paired with this idiosyncratic veneer of democratization. Advocates of privatization argued that dismantling the network of corruption that drained state resources required opening up the state's monopolistic hold on sectors of the economy to market competition. This would leave corrupt union bosses and state company administrators without source of illegal income. Now, this vision, of course, would prove pretty narrow-minded and mostly exploited for discretionary political purposes. Right? For example, in 1989, President Carlos Salinas moves the PRI firmly towards neoliberalism, selling off hundreds of state-owned companies, Joaquín Hernández Lacina, the union leader of the state-owned oil company, Pemex, threatens to strike if Salinas tries to privatize the public enterprise. Now, this union leader, Lacina, had enjoyed the protection of the state during the 3 decades as head of the union, during which time he became immensely wealthy. Salinas decides spares Pemex from being privatized, but imprisons Lacina. And this gives way to what is known as Quinazo, which is a move that was undertaken by several presidents of the neoliberal period after him, which is essentially trying to appear as if they're fighting corruption by capturing a central figure of the statist past, usually a union boss. Right? Now, as I said, this is mostly used for discretionary political purposes. Many of these union bosses are eventually freed, or they get replaced by sort of an equivalent corrupt union boss. So neoliberal anti-corruption measures, however opportunistic, can't even deliver on that promise, right? They become little more than a cover for the status quo. Right? But even honest proponents of the idea that fighting corruption required dismantling state enterprises miss the fact that not all corruption has the same causes. And the bloom of the neoliberal period brought about its own peculiar sort of corruption. Right? So if the general Keynesian state of the 30s to the 80s saw corruption predominantly in the form of routing of state-owned companies' monies to politicians' pockets, the restructuring of the relationship between the state and the economy beginning in the 90s witnessed the appearance of bribes for privileged access to the spoils of privatization of hitherto state-owned companies, and a growing market of government contracts for outsourced state services. Now, a famous example of this process is the rise of Carlos Slim, right, who is sort of close to the circles of power and is able to buy what used to be the state-owned telephone company under very beneficial conditions for him. So you have a whole class of mega wealthy businessmen that come about as the result of this privatization. Right? Now, the PRI loses power between 2000 and 2012, and there you have the neoliberal center-right taking hold, right, in the form of the PAN, right? The Party of National Action. But of course, nothing really gets done to solve this question of neoliberal corruption. They are sort of part and parcel of this phenomenon as well. So you really just have the proliferation in this period of this artificially inflated government contract, right? The basic scheme is companies would overcharge the state for services and give a cut to the official that facilitated the transaction. When the PRI took power back in 2012, under this premise of this new PRI, as they called themselves, of course, nothing changed, right? Just to pick an example of this, on his inauguration day, Peña Nieto took what is now an infamous picture with 19 state governors, many of whom represented this new party. By the end of his term, 10 of those 19 governors would have faced serious accusations of corruption. Some would flee the country. A handful would end up in jail. The most extreme case is that of the governor of the state of Veracruz, who, when in power, created over 30 fake companies that would secure contracts from the government, and he managed to steal an estimated $3 billion. Right? So this is serious, right? Sort of serious condition here. So in response to this wave of scandals, there's a constitutional reform in 2015, the National Anti-Corruption System. Right? This is basically designed to increase coordination between local, state, and national agencies, monitor expenditures, etc. What's important to understand here is that this reform process, although it was responding to widespread public outrage, was pushed primarily by business sector-led organizations, like the organization Mexicans Against Corruption and Impunity, headed by businessman Claudio González, or the think tank Mexican Institute for Competition, which is headed at the time by Juan Pardinas, who is now the editor of this violent anti-left newspaper Reforma. So these anti-corruption efforts are essentially led by capitalists. Led by this fraction of capital, these efforts assumed that the solution to endemic corruption in the country lay in finding the correct state institutional design, not in altering the particular relationships between the state and the economy brought about by the neoliberal period. That assessment would soon be challenged. So now enter López Obrador. So in his campaign last year, he made the case that the three kind of central issues, sort of ongoing problems of Mexico, were interrelated. The three axes of the campaign: ending corruption, regaining peace in a country ravaged by the drug war, and using the state as an engine for redistributive development, were fundamentally connected for him. Corruption cripples the state's capacity to energize the economy, and the growth of organized crime is a consequence of this long-standing economic slump. His development strategy looks to channel existing government funds into a series of large-scale programs, including a jobs program for young adults, substantial infrastructure projects, and price guarantees and subsidies for small agricultural producers in severely depressed regions, without imposing any tax hikes. So in this sense, López Obrador has hinged his administration's social spending budget on successfully combating corruption, and also has re-legitimized, in this sense, the redistributive role of the state. As he put it during the campaign, eradicating corruption would moralize public life, but would also free up a lot of resources for the development and well-being of the population. Now, he has also pushed a second point that has challenged the establishment's understanding of corruption. As he said in his inaugural speech, "I insist the distinctive feature of neoliberalism is corruption. It sounds harsh, but privatization in Mexico has been synonymous with corruption. Unfortunately, this ill has almost always existed in our country, but what has taken place during the neoliberal period has no precedent. Political power and economic power have fed off each other, and it has become modus operandi to steal the goods of the people." So connecting the issues of neoliberalism and anti-corruption for him implies that the solution can't lie on a redesign of the state institutions, simply, right? It has to do with a fundamental reworking of the relationship between market and state. So in this sense, in combating corruption, there's a reclaiming of the role of the state in providing services directly rather than outsourcing, and in shielding state enterprises from privatization. So the neoliberal project was initially able to take up the mantle of anti-corruption when it sought to dismantle state enterprises that were siphoning off resources. But the neoliberal era brought about its own peculiar set of type of corruption in the form of privileged access to privatization. It's in this context, for example, that AMLO announced a few weeks ago the formal end of the neoliberal era. The mantle of the fight against corruption now lies firmly on the side of the anti-neoliberal agenda. And there's other examples of this, which, I mean, I'd be happy to go into in the discussion afterwards, right? For example, his dismantling of the bloated salaries of high administrators of the state, this phenomenon he calls Republican austerity, right? It's also this instance of taking middle-class concerns, folding them in a sense as in a way to advance working class interests, or as an anti-elitist program, right? Another interesting example of this is the labor reform that is being discussed literally this moment. This is an important labor reform that would essentially introduce democratization to unions in Mexico, something that doesn't exist, right? As I was mentioning, the way that unionization developed in the 20th century in Mexico was it's a highly authoritarian form linked to the state. Right? this new reform would introduce all sorts of measures that would facilitate workers establishing unions. Now, in order to get this through, he is using the renegotiation of NAFTA as leverage. Right? His basic point is essentially the Canadian delegation is pushing for renegotiation of NAFTA only if certain labor conditions or labor rights pairing is established. So middle classes, upper classes of Mexico, if you want NAFTA renegotiated, if you want NAFTA re-signed, we need to get this labor reform passed. Right? So again, we have this, as I said, elite measures, anti-elite measures sort of folded into this coalition. Right? Now, the limits of left-wing populism, I think, are plain to see, right? The notion of this mafia in power, you know, is a limiting form, right? It's not a particular class in the sociological sense, right? It's a nebulous concept. It allows him to create a general narrative of the people against an elite, right? But it doesn't quite define the elite in class terms. And in this sense, the detractors of the right that see his use of this notion of the mafia in power as this kind of dangerous tactic of social polarization, I think, miss the fact actually that by using this concept, he implies that there's the possibility actually of harmonizing interest between the upper classes and the lower and middle classes, right? Which is arguable to say the least. And of course, this coalition, this bloc between working classes and the petty bourgeoisie that we see right now is volatile, right? By definition, right? So we know what happens, for example, if this type of coalition breaks down, right? In the case of Bolsonaro's rise in Brazil. Right? That said, of course, this is an important moment in the country. You have, as I said, basically a consensus around this generally left-wing project. You have a opposition right that is completely disarticulated, remains in shock after their astounding defeat, and offer no alternative for the moment. So the moment is ripe for some serious transformation in that sense. Okay, I'll end there. Yeah, thanks.